Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet. G'day, wild listeners. I hope you're enjoying your summer or your winter if you're on the other side of the planet. I've been taking a few weeks off from doing new recordings, but I have been sharing some of the most popular or my favourite episodes the last couple of weeks. And today I'm sharing with you a chat that I had with my meditation teacher, Tim Brown. Now, as it turns out, it is one of the most popular wild episodes ever. And what we talk about, I guess, are a bunch of themes that I think are particularly pertinent for this time of year. They're very expansive ideas. They're very inspiring ways of viewing things. I think you might enjoy this one.
Yep, Tim's a lot of things. He's taught more than 4,500 people to meditate over almost 20 years, including elite athletes, the Wallabies, the Australian cricket team, inmates at Long Bay Jail, artists, billionaires, and a lot of kids. He's also been my meditation teacher for the past 12 or 13 years and a constant in my life while I've moved around the world nomadically and restlessly as I wrote books, quit jobs and businesses, lost babies, almost lost my life, and generally rode my roller coaster. He's also super real. And it's been 12 years of guidance. I don't have a priest, I have you.
and I, by the way.
I quote Tim a fair bit in my books and about the place. You might recall he boldly asked me in First We Make the Beast Beautiful, "Sarah, do you want to be right or to love?" Lindsay, the producer here, tells me that was on page 120, I think. He also told me to make my journey in this one wild and precious life as much fun as I could, because humans change when the new way of living is more enjoyable than the status quo. "But Sarah," he said, "you love this journey. You love the wildness that you've found. So show us how to find the charm." And Lindsay, I think that's page 104 for anyone looking. So I figured it would be really good to have him come here and chat on this podcast to drill down on one of his wild wisdoms. We catch up pretty much weekly, I guess, to have the kind of conversation you're going to hear today. We cry a bit. We wrestle with a few truths. And this time we do it in a radio station studio with Lindsay, the producer, sitting next to us, nodding her head as she does when we make a good point. I started by asking him how he remembers our first meeting.
I remember the day you crawled up the stairs in Paddington and you said to me, "I've had three people tell me in the last 72 hours also that I need to come and see you, and I don't believe in any of this meditation bullshit, but I've been told three times in the last 72 hours, and when I hear something three times, I do something about it. So here I am." And you gave me the full workover. You know, you said you're a preppy looking this, that, and the other.
I said I had a prejudice against you.
You certainly did. And you didn't say it in that nicer terms, to be honest. It made me laugh. And I think you were expecting pushback or something. And I laughed, and we had a great old giggle about it. But
I think your exact words were you just looked at me squarely and you said, meditation will help with that.
Or it might anyway. I think that might have been the case. And I could just see how tired you were and how your nervous system was, you know, really under so much pressure. And, you know, your push out into the world to make a contribution was having such a taxing effect on you. And I remember you said, I've got to go and do this job somewhere or other and then I'll come back and then we'll do this thing. And, you know, once again, I don't believe in any of it, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I guess that's what I loved about you is that you were willing to step into the unknown. And I think you came back and your car had been stolen and, you know, the job hadn't gone so well and there'd been a cyclone and a coup or something
I'd
or other.
I'd gone diving with sharks on some island in the Solomon Islands and I got stranded. You're right.
That's right.
All three planes in the whole place went down and I was stranded on an island with people who were having actually family, like actually a coup.
Yeah, and I remember you saying there was a coup and I thought, and I remember you came back and I think your car had been stolen while you'd been away with that had all your worldly possessions in
it. My surfboard and my bike in it, yeah.
And I remember you saying to me, you came in to learn to meditate and I said, and you said, look, I'm not sure about all of this, but just do whatever it is that you're going to do to me.
Well, that's a really good segue into the one wild idea that I wanted to discuss with you. And there are so many wild ideas we've discussed over the last, really, it's 12 years.
Yeah.
I think that was 12 years ago. It was right at the point where I'd left my post at Cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
I'd got very, very sick.
Mm.
And it was shortly before I got to a point where I was no longer able to walk and work and everything was – that was the beginning of my stripping down.
Yeah, yeah.
And you entered my life at that point and you've been on the journey with me the whole way.
It's been amazing to watch.
I think very early on you shared a one wild idea with me which I've been challenged by ever since. And I use it as part of my phraseology about the place.
Mm.
You know, it's almost become part of my whole psyche. Mm. And I want to break it down with you because
sure.
there's so many aspects to it and I think people listening would really enjoy it. And that is, you said to me once, Sarah, this is in the context of get your filthy mitts off it,
yes,
which is another thing that you say to me often.
Yes.
Your white-knuckled grip, take it away.
Yeah.
You said to me, to be rendered choiceless is the ultimate freedom.
Yes.
And it took me quite some time for that to settle in. Can you explain it in your words?
Yeah, I think that original idea was, you know, part of the instruction around meditation, which was, you know, moving away from control. You know, rather than controlling all aspects is giving permission or allowing. And that comes right back to that principle of trust. You know, we've got to trust the process. And inside of meditation, what we're doing is delegating, you know, to that intelligence in the mind and body that's structuring and organizing 6 trillion things per second to allow a process to unfold. And that's where we kind of came across that idea of, you know, get your filthy little mitts off it because, you know, that amazing Sarah intellect was always deeply involved in trying to structure and organize and control all variables. And so with meditation, one of the ideas is giving permission to and allowing a process to unfold. And that has a principle in behind it, which is that principle of trusting rather than doubting. As soon as we move down that path of doubt, then very quickly we move into controlling or attempting to control all variables. And that really is a path to suffering and in so many ways.
It really does require, and this is something that you said to me quite recently, is it requires a choice to trust.
Yes, yeah.
You've got to choose to trust.
Yes.
And I think this is something that you've been exploring with a lot of your clients.
Yeah.
I don't like using the word clients. It's sort of almost your congregation
or
I don't know, your crew.
Community.
Community that come to you seeking guidance. And there's a lot of pain out there.
Yeah.
How's that choosing to trust lesson relevant right now? Why do you think it's important?
Even more so where I think where all the visual and all the information that's coming, there's so much disturbance and shift and movement and paradigm changing. It's so easy to kind of get into that mode that everything's, you know, we can get into that kind of henny penny, you know, the sky's falling, the sky's falling, the sky's falling. And I think this is the time that it's even more important to choose to trust. And I like using the phraseology, you know, run an experiment of choosing to trust.
Mm.
You know, just run an experiment, give it a go and see what happens. And I think that's, you know, that takes some real courage and bravery.
But it's also really playful.
It is, isn't it?
Because you've used that with me so many times. And another way that you say it, and I'm going to bring in all your little lessons as we go along. We're going to layer this up a fair bit.
It'll be good for me to hear this. It's always good to hear what I've said to people.
Revisit it.
Yeah.
You say, let's see.
Yeah.
And I actually even remember the space I was in when you told me this. Sarah, let's see. Let us see.
Yes.
Us being you, me, and the whole flow of life.
Yes.
Let's see what happens if we run this experiment.
That's right. So it's, and then that experiment is choosing to trust when we could choose to doubt, you know, and being a willing participant in running that experiment, and then let's see what unfolds. The intellect's constantly seeking evidence. But if we continue to run the doubt model, that the doubt experiment, it's an experiment as well. It's an application. You know, let's see what happens when you run that. And what we find is that we can find that we're running that all the time. We don't actually realize that we're doing it. And again, when you think about that doubt experiment, when you run down that path, it's just into chaos and anarchy and all kinds of, you know, horrible, you know, kind of an experience. We choose to trust that there is intelligence in play, always willing to admit that we can't see it. You know, I'm willing to do that every single day. It's like, how on earth can there be intelligence in this? But you know what? I'm going to run the experiment of choosing to trust. And if we can keep the camera rolling on this whole thing. One of my favorites. Let's keep the camera rolling here. Choose to trust. Run the experiment. Let's see how this unfolds. Keep the camera rolling. And ultimately, we see that, in fact, the story, there's intelligence. There's a thread through this. And the thread ultimately is evolution. You know, but it's not a linear, you know, it's not A to B linear. There's all these twists and turns and movements.
It reminds me of Steve Jobs' commencement address that he did, I think, sometime in the 90s. And he referred to the idea of sometimes you've just got to have sheer years on the planet to be able to turn around and see where all those random dots connect up.
That's it.
There's probably some of us listening to this going, I'd like a tangible example. And you speak to so many people. I think you've instructed thousands of people to meditate, but then even more in terms of the counsel that you've provided in jails, schools, sporting teams. Have you got some examples of somebody who's done that trust exercise and just to show how it pans out when you leap like that?
I think you're a great example. I mean, you know, back to the MasterChef days, right down, remember back in the beginning there. And, you know, I remember you, you know, you're inside of that environment and it was, you know, it was that first kind of visual step for you out after, you know, having a pretty rough time and all of the challenges that came around that. And
are you referring to that moment where I had a big, massive, I'd say meltdown, but it was an explosion?
Well, even going back another, your health issues, you know, and the challenges that have come. Look what's come out of that for both you and so many other people. You know, if we snapshot and go disaster, you know, there's no intelligence in this. This is all wrong. There's no intelligence in this process whatsoever. We keep the camera rolling. We keep connecting the dots. We keep moving forward. You know, use that analogy of the dot to dot. It's an analogy I use often. You know, what's the next dot? What's the next dot? You don't need to know what the thing is. Remember as a kid, you know, being put in front of those dot-to-dot books, you didn't need to know what the picture was. You just needed to find dot one. And when you're at one, two wasn't far away, and then three. And do you remember that beautiful experience of not really thinking about what you're doing, just finding the next dot? Yeah. And that beautiful, is it a cat? Is it a dog? Is it, you know, do you remember that feeling?
Yeah.
That beautiful feeling.
It's also like hiking.
Yes.
You go around a corner and I don't know where it's all going to end up, but yeah, on the way,
yes,
there's the anticipation, but there's also the enjoyment of one step in front of the other.
That's the beautiful thing. Mm. And we're coming back to that principle of choicelessness as well, you know, which is, you know, there's only one dot, you know, that's the next ultimate dot. And what we've got to work out how to do is to be able to access what that next one dot is. You know, the experience where, and again, to stretch that analogy I use is where, if the dots have all got numbers on them, then joining the dots is a delightful experience. If all the numbers drop off the dots and then you're told to start to, you know, to join those dots, then that whole thing becomes a very confusing and ambiguous kind of process.
Chaos.
And you can join all the dots, but what comes of it? And I think what we're looking to be able to do is to identify what that next dot is. And from, you know, the philosophy in behind what I teach, the idea is that there is only one supremely evolutionary thing to be doing in any given moment. There's one ultimate dot. The question is, can we pick up what that one dot is? And that's what we're really looking to be able to do, is to cultivate a neurophysiological state, a mind-body state that can identify what that next dot is. Otherwise, you know, there's all the dots, there's all kinds of possibilities. It's been advocated that choice is wonderful. Choice is a nightmare.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
The science now shows that, you know, it's the ultimate paradox.
Yeah.
Choice actually confounds to a point where we can't decide any further.
Brings anxiety and we can become catatonic through choice. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what we're looking to be able to do is to identify what that next dot is. And if we can identify what that is, then the whole process becomes a delightful one. And we don't need to know. We can trust that there's this thing unfolding. We don't know what it is. We can't see where it's going, but we can be devoted and enthusiastic to that process.
You talk about the fact that the universe has a logic, an intelligence, you say.
Yes.
And that's hard to fathom. There is, as I say, a side of us that knows it to be true,
yes.
Right? And it's a beautiful feeling deep inside of us. Mm. And when we hear people like you talk about it in a way, it provides this recognition, right?
Yeah.
It brings it to the surface and we go, oh, my God, I'm loving the fact that it's been put into words. There's this recognition and it feels safe and it feels there's this beautiful congruence. Can I get you to extrapolate it further and use the example of my various tortured forays into television and or whatever if you need to, or if you've got a better example, please do. But just ways that maybe where somebody has chosen to trust that universal intelligence
and it's
worked out
as
it needed to.
Yeah, and I think you are a perfect example of, you know, that, you know, your foray into, you know, into Cosmo and all of those things, and then, you know, that kind of finished up, and then that led into, you know, the MasterChef, which, you know, and your health challenges, which led into...
And I had no idea what it was about,
exactly,
right?
Exactly right.
I'd go, because Kerri-Ann Kennelly rang me the day after I tried to kill myself. Mm. And I was getting acupuncture to try to stimulate my ovaries because I'd been told I was infertile. And she rang me and said, could you fill in for me on television? And that's where it all started from.
Yeah.
I think I probably rang you straight after going, oh, Tim, what's this about?
And so, you know, we know, we can see that it's happening. It's happening all of the time. The question is, can we, you know, can we engage with that and rather than resisting that process, it's happening anyway. You know, the question is, can we go with that process? One of my favorite movies of all time is Groundhog Day. You know, I mean, I talk about this movie every day of the week. You know, there's the Bill Murray character, reluctant, recalcitrant, resistant. He's an absolute pain in the ass, that guy.
Filthy mitts on everything.
Oh, God, he's all over it. And he doesn't want to be there and he gets locked in that same experience again and again and again. You know, he ends up jumping off the bell tower, you know, wakes up the same morning, you know. Mm-hmm. I got you, babes, on the radio once again. And he goes through that process and he's caught in that loop. It is hell on earth until something shifts, and it's got nothing to do with anything outside of him. It's got to do with something inside of him. And, of course, it's about getting the girl. It's about love ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he starts to realize he can kind of see what's going on. Mm. And all of a sudden he starts kind of running the experiment of trusting that there's intelligence in this process. And he starts to kind of gently, not, he just doesn't turn the lights on the whole thing. He gently starts to run the experiment of engaging willingly in that process. And it didn't all turn around in the next day. It was a gradual process where he continued to run that process of choosing to trust, engaging willingly in the process, and the whole experience started to change. It went from hell on earth to heaven on earth, a playground for him.
Mm.
And he was popping out of bed in the morning, jumping up, you know, saying hello to everybody, you know, pulling the Heimlich on the guy in the kitchen, you know, catching the kid out of the tree.
You have watched this movie a few times. Yeah.
Helping the old girls with it. He ends up speaking French. By the end of it, he is just having a ball and nothing outside of him changed. And I think this is really, I guess, what I've tried to break down into that, you know, nice philosophical kind of idea, but how do you break that down into a very practical, action-based thing? For me,
that's my next question. I think, you know, when you're rendered choiceless, it's the ultimate freedom. So do we go out and try to render ourselves choiceless, get rid of all the choices, or is it about just joining life as subsuming, or is it a bit of both? Because you know that I have a fundamental issue with being passive.
Yes.
I feel that there's got to be this also engagement at the same time.
Yeah.
If you could sort of explain that aspect of things.
Yeah, I think you know, choosing to trust that there is intelligence, you know, it's running and just running that experiment. You don't have to believe it. It's just about running an experiment. There's something about that terminology.
One.
Yeah, just decide to run an experiment of choosing to trust and see what happens. And I do it all day. You know, I get caught behind a car and I've got a fiery temperament. You know, I'm like, oh, you know, can't this person, you know, I can see myself kick in.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what I'm doing here is I'm actually choosing to doubt that there's intelligence in this. Inevitably, if I choose to trust, I relax, enjoy. Inevitably, I see that that slowed me down, that got me to, you know, to that corner at that point, that there's the friend across the road, you know, and the synchronicity and the serendipity and the flow of experience kicks off.
Yeah.
And that's where that real joy and we start to see that intelligence in play and that we're a part of it. Otherwise, we choose to doubt, we resist, resent, we push, we shove, we try and control, we get in the way, the whole thing's, you know, to use one of your favorite terms, a clusterfuck.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite words of yours, you know, and then there's no intelligence in the universe and we can't trust it, we've got to control it, and we get stuck in that model.
Oh, it's boring.
Yeah, and I think it's also a very, you know, in the truest sense of the word, a very masculine, we've been running this very masculine head-based model. And one of the great, you know, shifts that's taking place is this rise of the feminine. And we've all got the masculine and feminine. They're aspects of ourselves. And one of the great themes of this age is the rise of the feminine, which is the heart, which is heart, which is intuition, which is engagement with a broader intelligence.
Yeah.
That's what this is all about. But we've been running this very, very masculine head-based model. And it's not about getting rid of that. It's about bringing those two things together.
Yeah,
The sweet spot. It's all about the sweet spot and about getting that heart and head working together. But to do that, we've got to invite that in. And for me, that revolves really around this principle of choosing to trust.
That's the action, isn't it?
It is.
It's not a passive thing where you go, hey, I'm not going to really care. I'm going to be the flotsam floating around, letting the tides take me wherever, and that is not the answer.
No, it's not.
It's a deliberate choice. It's really interesting as you talk about this, and it's always been the case. I feel it resonating in my heart space, you know, and I can feel my heart responding and relaxing into that knowledge.
Yeah.
And it's an alien feeling for many of us. But again, that's, I think, something that we need to trust.
Yeah, I think that is the thing of this age. We've got to choose to trust, and things are moving so quickly, you know, and we're seeing that on all levels, you know, things that the dynamics. I was watching a TED talk not that long ago. It's one of the world's leading neuroscientists saying someone living in a city anywhere in the world in 2020-21 is being exposed to the same levels of stimulation in one day that someone 200 years ago would have been exposed to in their whole lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, change cycles are just moving so quickly. You know, the human brain and nervous system is being challenged by that. You know, how do we work out how to operate inside of this paradigm without being completely overwhelmed and consumed and, you know, mentally, physically and emotionally compacted and compressed through this process? That's the real challenge of this age. For me, that I think that, you know, it keeps coming back to that idea of you know, we've got to choose to trust that there's intelligence. We've got to find that beautiful sweet spot between making our individual contribution and allowing that intelligence that we're connected to in all kinds of ways to play. And that's the beautiful dance. It's what we call the Leela. Leela means the dance.
Yeah.
And it's about finding
a Vedic term.
It's a Vedic term. You know, it's that dance of making our contribution, not overdoing it, not underdoing it. You know, it's just right, that Goldilocks phenomenon. And I think that is the constant challenge I find in my life every single day in every relationship that I have. Where's that sweet spot? And, you know, if I'm all stressed and tired and mentally constricted, the ability to find that is so difficult and compromised.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What are some of the things that people can do to access this in better and more refined ways in their lives? Because, gosh, we need it right now. I mean, we're talking at such an interesting juncture in history.
Oh, it's incredible.
We need to be sharing this kind of information.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's what I love about your book and the way that, you know, you've found, you know, one of your really deep ways is to immerse yourself in nature. I mean, I love immersing myself in salt water, you know, complete immersion in nature. And I think what that does, it's that principle of sympathetic vibration, you know, which is you immerse yourself in nature and you realign yourself, just like you put a piano in one corner of a room and put a guitar on the other side of the room. You hit the C on the piano, and the C chord, the C string on the guitar on the other side of the room will vibrate.
So music is another way. I mean, not everybody has access to the ocean or maybe being able to get into nature, especially at the moment because lockdowns are just coming and going all over the place. So I think music's a really good example.
Absolutely. You know, and I think
creation of any sort by other humans.
Absolutely is a creative process, is going to be immersion. You know, we talk about nature being, you know, outside in trees and stuff, but in fact there is only one nature. There is, that's really the thing. Quantum field physics is talking about the one whole indivisible conscious field expressing itself in infinite diversity while maintaining its unified nature at all times. This is the statement of unified field theorem, quantum field physics.
Yeah.
There is only actually one thing. There's not nature and us. There's nature. There's this one field, right? And I think, you know,
That's the universal intelligence you keep coming back
to. That's it. That's the uni, one verse, song, one song.
Yeah.
That's the one thing. And this whole idea that there are two things, that whole theory is completely falling apart, that there are two things. There's only one thing. And so I think back to your question, how do we get immersion into that? That's really the great question.
Mm.
And I think, you know, you do it with your hiking. It really activates that within you. I get people all the time, they'll say, I get that when I paint or I surf or I play music or... and of course, meditation is learning how to immerse oneself, to move beyond individuality into universality, to really settle the mind, relax the body, expand and open consciousness. And we've seen an explosion in the interest in that in the last 20 years. When I started teaching 20 years ago, you know, my background, this was not on my radar. I was a rugby playing, beer drinking, agricultural economist. 20 years ago, you know, country boy, all of those, this was not on my radar.
Hence my prejudices when I arrived to meet
perfectly
you.
Perfectly legitimate. well-founded.
<Yeah.
laughs> we've seen in the last, even the nine years, we've seen, the calm, headspace, insight timer, smiling minds, all these things. This is just pushing its way into the collective consciousness. When I first started teaching 20 years ago, I'd go to a birthday party or a dinner party, you know, someone would say, what do you do for a living? I'd say, I teach meditation. They pick up their drink and walk up the other end of the bar.
It's like saying you're a superannuation consultant or something.
That's right. And, you know, now, you know, this is just becoming part of general parlance. What is it? It's about immersing ourselves in our own broader nature. That's ultimately what meditation is.
Tim, you're talking to people daily, hourly. I know it exhausts you and I know that things are speeding up.
Mm.
How would you describe where humans, our pain point is at? Where is our pain point? Because I think it really helps to know that we're not alone.
Yeah.
Could you describe it so that we can have some recognition?
Yeah, I mean, I sat with some people yesterday that have just been through the most extraordinary experience. You know, a a son, a 15-year-old son, you know, dropping dead, you know, right in front of them.
Mm.
No signs, you know, to see what humanity can experience.
Yeah.
And weather and the resilience of it, it's just extraordinary. And not even at that level, like just people being in this world and the dynamics and the movement and the change. I mean, when I left, you know, university 25 years ago, none of us had an email address. No one had a mobile phone. I ended up living in Uzbekistan growing cotton for 3 years for whatever, some strange reason, but, you know, an amazing experience I ended up having.
Following some dots.
Yeah, following charm fearlessly. That's where I ended up.
Yeah.
You know, that was 25 years ago. Between 25 years, you know, the internet has arrived, you know, mobile phones, computers. I mean, you know, the world and you know, I was watching a bit of Elon Musk yesterday, you know, the talk about AI and where that's all going. And I mean, things are just moving so quickly. It amazes me how people, you know, get out of bed in the morning and move into their lives. I mean, I was walking around the street here in Goulburn Street, just looking at people thinking that person made a decision to get out of bed this morning and put some clothes on. And, you know, and goodness knows what's happening in their life.
How does that make you feel when you have those expansive moments of seeing humans? Because you can see their pain, right?
Oh, I can see. You can see that whole thing. And I'm in wonderment, you know, of how, you know, people do get out of bed and get into their lives and move. And the young lady that served me, you know, my coffee this morning, I was like, what's going on in her life? You know, and she smiled and made me my coffee. I thought,
and tried her best.
And did her best. I mean, it's amazing what humanity is doing and what humans will do. And
is there a way that you can sum up where our collective pain is at right in this moment?
I think my distillation of it is that I think for the last couple of thousand years, we have been so enmeshed in relativity. In the outside material world, we have been so outwardly externally orientated. And I think my humble opinion is that I think we are being pushed into and we're being moved towards being rendered choiceless about exploring other realms. And those realms are, you know, the not physical manifest realms. I think we're being asked to look within. And I think when we look at history, we see that when humanity got to levels of, you know, collective discomfort and pain, which generally came from over engagement, over expectation in the relative world, material world, great teachers turned up and they've all said exactly the same thing. I'm here to remind you, essentially they've said the same thing. I'm here to remind you that which you truly seek, what it is that you're really after, is within you. Stop looking outside. And I think we are getting to that level. I see, my interpretation is that we've been so externally orientated and so fascinated on the external. And we don't want to get rid of that. It's not about getting rid of it. It's not about desecrating that. It's not about disengaging from that. But we have to start to look within ourselves for, you know, for something that is quiet, that is still, that is unbounded, that is stable, that is secure, because they are things that every human desires. They are fundamental desires that must be satiated. And if we're looking in the outside world for those things, stability, security, non-change, contentment, peace, then we are looking in the wrong place, because this outside world is proving itself to be changing and it's moving more quickly. It's unstable. It's all of those things. And that's what it is.
We talk about this a bit, Tim. We often get together maybe weekly to talk through this stuff.
Yeah.
In part, it's a psychology session for the two of us. We bring each other down from the ceiling or from the edge of the cliff. And I think
I really value those conversations, by the way.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. And it's been 12 years of guidance. I don't have a priest. I have you.
and I, by the way. Let's make very clear that's a reciprocal experience.
Yeah. We have contrasting perspectives, but we tend to land in a similar spot.
Mm.
But I think it's the beauty and the comfort, if I can put it this way, in what you're talking about here, which is the reality, is that life is taking us to the place we've always wanted to go to, which is that rendering of choice.
That's right. Yeah.
Many people out there, the pain point is that they say, this doesn't make sense.
Yes.
I'm so uncomfortable with this, it must be wrong.
That's right.
And the big, beautiful, simple, elegant lesson is that actually, no, it's so much better than that.
Yes.
It's exactly where we need to be, and it's going to take us to where not only do we need to go to feel peace, but then it enables us to then take that centeredness and truth out into the world. And you know that that's the big caveat that I add to everything is, let's get centered and true and peaceful and then come down from the mountain and help and be of service.
That's right.
We have to have these conversations to remind ourselves, you know, you and I do it, we lose track and we have to sort of have these conversations regularly to go, oh, remember, all makes sense.
That's it.
And it's actually easier than we kind of are thinking about this.
Yeah,
you know,
Mother Nature says come willingly or come in cuffs. How do you want to do this? But you're coming. And
again, it's that deliberate choice, choose to trust.
What's the big theme? Everything is evolving. You know, the thing is, everything must evolve. Mother Nature says to everything, you know, evolve. And we either do that willingly or we get rendered choiceless, you know, in an uncomfortable way. But the way I talk about it is Mother Nature, you know, she'll whisper in our ear. And if we ignore that, she'll tap us on the shoulder. If we ignore that, she'll poke us in the chest. If we ignore that, she'll slap us across the face, right up to what I call the cosmic kick up the Khyber. You know, where you get bent over and you get that great big boot up the bum and, you know, and we get to choose. This is where us humans get to choose where we engage with that process.
Some of us, we have to go to that cosmic kick up the Khyber before we get the lesson and then
there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it. I've had it many times and, hey, I sit here to tell the story and I'm grateful for it when I look back and join the dots.
Yeah.
I'm a stubborn, highly cerebral person. I wouldn't have got the lesson any other way.
I think it's the whole point that we're here. I think it's right to take it to that limit to find out where that kick is and how much it hurts. And that motivates us to then go, you know, is it possible to do this a
more
little
artfully,
earlier?
A little
more gracefully, more elegantly.
That's right.
But
that's
so there's nothing wrong with that. And I think, you know, individually and collectively. It's just a good visual example at the moment. I mean, for instance, American politics, you know, we've seen that where it's gone, you know, what's that come from? Apathy, you know.
Oh yeah.
Great word. And, that's brought, and it's brought a discomfort, you know, that's got people thinking and engaging and in ways that we haven't seen for generations. And not only in America, but us. I mean, I'm thinking, I look at that and then I bring that back home. How does that apply? How do those lessons apply here? You know, how do we avert the danger, you know, that has, or that event that's taken place there, those situations? How do we not repeat that? How can we be more vigilant? You know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, is the saying of the Return Services League. How do we become, you know, develop a consciousness so that these destructive events, you know, don't necessarily have to happen as often or as deeply.
What are you doing to that effect at a personal but also professional level?
Yeah. I think, you know, what it drives back really back to me is, I've got to develop a conscious state that can be broad, you know, that can maintain its awareness, be artful, to be able to engage in my own personal internal experience and with all the personal relationships that I have in a way that is connecting, is evolving, is growing, is all of those things. I think I work on that very individual level within my own self and then assisting other individuals to do that within their own lives is develop a conscious state that can be not hypervigilant, but to be aware and to be conscious and to be artful. And I think that is what I feel, you know, meditation assists people to do is to develop a conscious state that can maintain an open conscious state. Because I think in this day and age, we are being mentally, physically and emotionally impacted and compressed from all directions. And we've got to work out the real challenge of this age is how do we open and expand our conscious state, open our mental, physical, and emotional repertoire in a world that is compressing it. And therein lies the ultimate challenge, because everything then comes out of that. I know when I get tired and stressed, you know, when I get compacted, you know, my relationship with myself and with my family and with work, everything just feels
brittle
and unpleasant and not fun or interesting or any of those things. I become an unwilling participant. Mm-hmm. and I think we've got to work out how we can cultivate a conscious state where we can be in this whole great big experience, this incredible time in human history, and not be consumed and overwhelmed by it. And I think that really is the level that I try and work on, is how do we, you know, really maintain a conscious state that can sustainably operate that way, because that's what the world desperately needs.
I'm going to hit you with a really tough question. And it's just been on my mind. I've been particularly sad and melancholy around it. And, you know, I'm sure other people are feeling the same. If one of us is feeling this way, I'm sure others are as well. This is a question that I put to you, and I put it to people in my book. What's left if we lose it all?
What's losing it all?
The world and our existence, humanity, is at a point where it might go one way or the other.
We
know this.
Definitely.
Climate change, civil war stemming from political fragmentation, even a pandemic that rolls and rolls and rolls.
Yes.
And it might not even be death or extinction. It could be losing the life and the dreams that we expected and anticipated and took for granted. So that's what I mean by lose it all. So what are we paired back to? I'm asking what's it all paired back to for you?
I mean, if you really want to go right to that outer edge.
I do.
Well, I think the ultimate thing is that, you know, from a conscious point of view, that humanity isn't the only conscious thing. You know, consciousness, nature, it will find a way forward, you know, and it will express itself in, you know, in all kinds of ways. You know, the human lifetime, what is it, 80, 100 years, something like this? It's just
a blip. Blink,
you know, and but we our whole framing of time and reality is based around our lifetimes. Which is just such a tiny little bit of time, you know, in the scheme of things. I was watching a thing on the cosmos last night about the cosmos, and it was like it's 300 billion years old or something. I was like, you know, in the frame of a human lifetime, you know, it's like
we need to get over ourselves.
What are we talking about here? Right? I mean, I think in the, you know, nature and nature's intelligence, you know, will find a way forward. It will ultimately, and maybe that's shaking humanity off this planet. Maybe that's, but you know, things will continue to evolve and find a way forward, and find a way. This intelligence, the universe, will find its way forward in some way or form. I think the question then begs is, as a species, how do we increase the possibility that we might be a part of that, and that we might be given the opportunity to experience that and witness it and be involved in it.
For longer.
Exactly. And the question is how do we align ourselves with nature's intelligence and be a part of that? And
that's the answer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Aligning ourselves with nature's intelligence is probably going to, well, it invariably, necessarily will give us the best chance of to see this beautiful existence unfold
for longer. In 1950, there were 2 billion humans on the planet. It took 250,000 years to get to 2 billion humans. Mm-hmm. 70 years later, we're at 7.5 billion people and growing by the day. If humanity keeps putting this expectation on the relative world, you know, to gain its stability, security, non-change, fulfillment, contentment, safety through relative acquisition, we're in trouble. This planet can't do that. So the question is, what is it that's going to change that? And I think that's what's going to drive us into, where do we find something that is stable, secure, non-changing, you know, content, that's got all of those elements within? And I think the answer to that is, that's within us. And we need to start looking there for that, not outside, because if we don't have access to that, and we've forgotten the art of that, really, we will go to the outside world and attempt to achieve those things in the outside world. And the thing is, it's not because we're not focused enough. It's not because we're not trying hard enough that we haven't got those things. It's because it can't be done. This outside world is the realm of change.
Tim, that was a beautiful note to end things on. So with these wrap-up sessions, I like to highlight some actionables that my guest has planted with us. But with my chat with Tim, I think it could be fruitful to pose a bunch of questions to pause and answer for ourselves in our own time. They all peg from his wild advice, which was to run an experiment of choosing to trust and see what happens. You might like to hit pause after each one. So the first one, what is the intelligence, this one thing that Tim speaks of? Is it something that you just know or feel to be true? How does it feel to radically trust this intelligence, to accept it and to love it? How do you already like to join this intelligence or this one thing? How do you already immerse in it in your life? And how can you just do more of it? Like, I hike and Tim immerses in the ocean. Most of us experience music as something that attunes us to this uni, this universe, this uni one verse song, this one song. Now, to be rendered choiceless, what does that even mean? This one took me ages to work out, actually. It's not being passive. It's an active willingness to move with life where it's going, I think. I like to use river metaphors a lot. It's getting in the canoe and moving down the river, but paying attention and steering things here and there, not getting tipped, and helping out others who might be struggling in the rapids. A big meaty part of this is accepting, actually, no, fully loving the discomfort that comes with this at times, of having to radically trust that where we are right now is necessary and even required. It's part of the dot-to-dot thing. Mostly, actually always, this discomfort is necessary to get us to wake up and to get more alive in our little canoes. Tim sat at traffic lights getting angry, and I think that was his example. And it was a reminder to keep the camera rolling, to observe how the dots all join up. I reckon it's a really helpful exercise to choose a moment from recent history, like a month ago, that might have stressed or annoyed me, that made me want to control the situation with my white-knuckled grip, and to sit back and see how the dots in fact joined and worked out as it all had to. It's a beautiful process. And finally, have you watched Groundhog Day? Perhaps we should all watch it again. But until next time, keep running your experiment. Join life, attune with nature. She's the best teacher in how to get truly wild.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.